The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
CSO says the poorest are hit hardest by cost of living crisis. Should a tax cut for the squeezed middle be a priority? What should be included in the upcoming gambling regulation legislation? And should Ireland help design and join an EU army? We'll have all that and more on tonight's Late Debate. And joining us in studio tonight, we have Shane Castles, Fianna Fáil Senator and Shannon spokesperson on media, arts, sports, tourism and the Gaeltacht. Lynn Boylan, Sinn Féin Senator and Shannon spokesperson for communications, climate action and environment, social protection and employment affairs. Mark Wall, Labour Senator and party spokesperson on defence, sport and tourism. And Hugh O'Connell, political correspondent with Independent Newspapers. We want to hear from you as well, so get in touch. Text us on 51551, email us on latedebate@ RTE.ie, or you can tweet to @LateDebateRTE. Now, new research from the Central Statistics Office shows that in March, households with the lowest incomes experienced higher inflation, up to 7.6% compared to the average rate of 6.7%. Those in the highest income category had annual estimated inflation of just 6.1%. Hugh O'Connell, the headline numbers in this Consumer Price Index, they won't come as a surprise to anyone. Obviously, everyone is feeling the pinch out there. But it does give us really more hard data now on who is getting hit hardest here.
Yeah, and I think it's kind of hitting people in different ways. I mean, I think for people in the lower end of the income spectrum, it's sort of the difference between whether they eat or they don't eat. And for those on kind of middle to higher incomes, it's perhaps the sort of discretionary spending that they might have had a year or two ago, they don't have any more now, and that they're kind of really to the pin of their collar every month, and they're kind of living from paycheck to paycheck. I mean, they're able to kind of feed themselves and clothe themselves and keep the house warm, but they're just about managing, and they're, you know, they might not be able to take a holiday this year, for example, which they might have been waiting to take for the last 2 years. So it is putting hard data to something I think that we've all been experiencing in different ways. I mean, I think everyone in this studio, even, you know, notwithstanding the comfortable living that we all might enjoy, we've all experienced the impact of the cost of living crisis. And I think that's obviously then more acute the further down the income brackets that you go. And it's exacerbating problems that already existed within the state, in terms of housing, in terms of access to healthcare, in terms of all sorts of issues that were already apparent pre-pandemic, during the pandemic, are now exacerbated by the fact that everything is costing a lot more. And the signs aren't good, I mean, or in terms of what lies ahead in the next few months, because, I mean, as the Taoiseach was saying in Brussels this week, the decision to do a sixth round of sanctions, which will impact on the Russian supply of oil to many European countries, is going to have a tangible effect on
energy prices. Yes,
and we've already been experiencing a pretty tangible effect on energy prices the last few months. And I think the difficulty, I think, as well, is that there's no easy political solution to this. There's no quick fix to this. Even everything that the opposition is proposing, even if implemented, I don't think would... it might lessen the burden somewhat. It might soften the blow somewhat.
Might it make some things worse?
It might. But let's just discount that for a second. I don't think it would have, you know, any major difference. In my view, it wouldn't make any major difference. I think this is just something that we're all living with, and we're all going to have to live with for the foreseeable future.
Lynn Boylan, this is just something we're going to have to live with?
No, I think, look, we've accepted that the government can't do everything to address this crisis, because this is a particularly bad set of circumstances that we find ourselves in. But they can do more, and they can do more targeted measures. And I think one of the things, and as Hugh said, where we had problems before in other areas, they're now becoming much more problematic. So the fact that rents have gone up, I think, by 8.4%, you know, so the government could address that, because your rent, if you're living in the rental accommodation, their inflation rates were quite high in that report. But also something that we've been calling for a long time is a ban on rent increases and putting that refundable tax credit back into people's pockets. So that's something that would be really tangible to a lot of the people out there who are renting. The same with childcare. Reduce those costs. So I think what people would like to see is the reduction in public services rather than income tax cuts, to actually deliver the services that people want, because we were a very expensive country before this crisis in accessing those services.
Yeah. Tánaiste de Leo Varadkar, in this exclusive interview with The Independent, telling us now that he wants to prioritise middle income families earning around 45,000 a year with budget measures, including tax cuts and reduced childcare costs. Would Fianna Fáil be supportive of a tax cut for the squeezed middle, Shane Castles?
Yeah, well, I think any supports that can be given to people within the measures of government and the array of powers that they have to try and ease the burden on people have to be considered. And Hugh was right, there's no quick fix to this. And that's why you've seen targeted measures across the board. Tonight on RT News, we've seen the Barnardo's organisation talking about the cost of people sending their children back to school in the new year for secondary school. And we've seen the increases in the back to school allowance to try and help that for €160 for children under 11 and €285 for children over 12.
Wasn't one of the criticisms in the fiscal advisory report that we had just this week was that of the huge amount of money, €2.4 billion, I think, is the top figure we're hearing for that has been put out towards this cost of living crisis, that 90% of it wasn't targeted, that most of it was spent on universal payments.
Well, there was actually a huge amount of targeting within that, whether that be in terms of, you know, allaying the cost of energy, whether it be in terms of even the supports that have been made available to hauliers, which, and every week, as has been said...
I know, that's the fiscal advisor, that's the actual data, that's not me making
it. I'm just saying in terms of the actual organisations that have been helped, because every week a new organisation...
A huge amount of the money has been spent on universal payments. Would you accept that? For better or worse,
that's what we've done. And trying to help people.
And in the context of those CSO figures, where we hear that the most vulnerable are struggling by far and away the most, mm-hmm. is a tax cut for middle-income earners, should that be the priority?
But again, people in the middle income, no more than anyone else, are suffering hard as well, because on paper, it might be seen they're doing okay. But when you factor in the cost of living and so forth, and in the context of that, you mentioned childcare. So, I mean, how do we actually try and help childcare on a long-term basis as well? Many years ago, Fianna Fáil introduced a €2,000 per annum payment, cash payment, for the childcare sector. Many opposed it in terms of you're making.
Well,
a
you
cash
touched, but you touched.
You made a cash payment.
Sorry, because not everybody is watching us on television. Yeah. You should know that when he said many opposed it, Shane gently touched Mark Wall's shoulder. Very gentle, but very pointed.
Thanks, yeah. Very pointed, because I mean, again, there's this whole debate in terms of where you put money. I'd actually say, and you know, I have a deep passion in the whole childcare industry and profession, that the money long term, and Fianna Fáil were the first to establish a Minister for Children, should be put into the structures, which is happening now. But again, it comes back to the point of people just want cash in pockets now. Is that the best solution? Probably not if you're trying to make sure that sectors like the childcare sector are looked after in the long term.
Okay, I still don't know though, where does Fianna Fáil stand on this suggestion by Leo Varadkar that what he's going to be looking for in the budget is a tax cut for middle income earners?
Well, you've got three parties in that government, and that's going to be trashed.
That's why I'm asking
over the coming months.
Yeah, so
I'm saying that I think anyway, in terms of how the government is actually going to respond.
Okay, no, sorry. I need to let Mark in. I just want to see if you had a position on that, but you don't have a position on that.
I do have a position on that. I actually said it at the outset, Katie,
I do believe
that people in the middle income should be helped. Yes,
and it should be a priority.
I think it should be helped. If you can reduce the cost of living through the suite of measures that government have available to them, and one of them is easing the tax burden, that is something that should be positively considered to help middle income families, 100%.
Okay, Mark.
Well, first of all, Katie, Hugh said people just about managing. Many people are not actually managing at the moment, and that's the truth of it. We have 380,000 people who are just living on a wage that is really at the minimum end of things, and those are the people that we need to target first, and those are the people that we need to help. I listened to a Barnardo's representative this morning talking about families coming to them, and I met with Vincent DePaul last week, and the stories are horrific. You talked about people who are struggling to put food on the table, and that is the reality for so many people that will be listening in tonight. That's where the targets need to be happening at the moment. You know, we've called for a summer bonus similar to the Christmas bonus. That's what needs to happen. People need to see money in their pockets. That's where the government should be targeting at the moment. And the other thing, I suppose...
Does that mean not at a squeeze middle tax
bill? Well, look, in fairness, there's a lot of people there, but we need to target the people that need it most, and those are the people that can't afford to put food on their table. Some of those are actually in middle, and I appreciate that as well. But those 380,000 workers, there's where we need to start, and we need to give them a raise in the minimum wage. That's what needs to happen here. We've asked for a summer welfare bonus, and you know, similar to what happens at Christmas time. That's needed, because the issue here is the budget is not until October. The problems are now, and we need to see government action now.
Do you want to respond to Shane's reference to the childcare and Labour stance?
Well, look, I appreciate Shane giving me the gentle touch there, in fairness. And Shane likes to talk about the past, and that's what a lot of people, when they're talking about the Labour Party, do. We'd rather talk about what's happening now, what's going to happen in the future. We propose the private childcare system. We've been proposing that from a time. It's a 60 million pilot scheme that we've proposed. That's what needs to happen, because it is a cost. In places where I come from, like Newbridge, it's the number one issue is childcare costs. I agree with Shane.
How much is the Labour Party proposal on this?
60 million, that's what we're proposing.
And what would that do? What would that do for people with their...
That would give people a break, and that's what we're talking about.
How much of a break? Just
what we're saying is that it would put money back in the pockets. It would make childcare affordable in Newbridge, where I'm talking about. It's a second mortgage that we're talking about. It's up to 15, 16.
Yeah, so if I'm paying €1,000, that's not an awful lot for what people are paying in crèches now. If I'm paying €1,000 today, under the Labour scheme, what would that do for that bill?
Well, that bill, we would reduce it by a percentage. I think the percentage that I'm, as far as I'm aware, is 25 to 30%, which would give that money back directly into people's pockets.
So I'd be paying 700, say.
Yeah, well, look, at the end of the day, that's what we're negotiating. That's what we're trashing out at the moment.
And that would only cost
60 million is what we've costed at the moment.
It's not a bottomless pit, though. And at the same time, we're trying to make sure that the people who are working in the childcare sector are paid a proper standard of living as well, because most of them are on a basic minimum wage as well. We have committed through the negotiations with the childcare sector that would be actually part of... It's not going to win any votes. It's not going to help, but it's going to help the people who actually have been qualified and are working in the childcare sector. And I'm sure as a Labour Party person, you would support that as well, that we're putting money into the people who work in the sector, so give them a proper
wage.
We'd
always support workers getting
absolutely,
that
Mark.
There's
but
absolutely
we can't,
no problem
absolutely,
with that,
and
you
so,
know that.
And so we have to make sure that the money that's available to childcare, where are we making the priority? In the first instance, we're actually going to pay the workers, because they've been ignored for the last 20 years since the establishment of that department.
But in paying the workers, we've also to recognise the bills that people are paying, hard-pressed, those middle classes that call the community
counters. But we have
like
to be,
where I live in Kildare, where you live in Meath, they're struggling to afford childcare, and we have to look at that.
And do you know how one of the problems there as well, as Mark, is actually the availability of the spaces as well, in terms of the actual sector. Because if you have got a dearth of places, they become a premium, and then that's what's driving up costs as well. So one of the big things is actually increasing the amount A of community childcare places, and B actually helping the private sector as well. We've got a system that's developed over the last 20 years where if we were starting from scratch, we would have had an actual public system. Unfortunately, we ended up funding a private system to do a government job, and that wasn't because we came from nowhere.
You could say the exact same thing for the housing sector, couldn't you?
We were the first to establish a Minister for Children, Hugh. There was nobody. Nobody took us seriously up until then. The late Brian Lenehan was the first Minister for Children.
Government from 1997 to 2011.
And established that. No one took us serious. We took us serious through the Minister for Children.
You said there that if you'd start from the beginning 20 years ago, we would have done it differently. The point is that 20 years ago Fianna Fáil were in government.
And 20 years ago, Hugh, if you understand the sector, it wasn't that that the government came from nowhere. The sector was there in an embryonic way, and we had to actually then regulate it and formulate it, because it was happening just in homes. It was happening in a kind of unregulated fashion. We brought in regulation to make sure that it actually would have the highest standards of childcare in Europe, which we have achieved. The problem is you've got so many in the private sector
the most expensive
carrying out that job on behalf of the state. But we're rebalancing that now. We're rebalancing. I'll give great credit to Roderick O'Gorman in what he's been doing in that department, because we've brought in a system now where through actually subvention, and this will take a number of years, you actually are going to see a reduction in the cost to parents, and at the same time actually fund. Because one of the big problems
when you say a number of years, Shane, what are we talking about?
Well, you would hope to do that over the next, even actually during the course of this government, Katie. And the biggest problem is, I go back to places, you actually have a huge amount of people leaving the sector, employees. They're actually just spun out. Why go and get a level 8 or so qualification and work for minimum wage in a very highly stressed position for maybe 12, 13 hours a day? And that's why it has been made a priority, and we're unashamedly saying this, going to make sure the staff are paid first and look after them.
Lynn, are you impressed by that?
Where to start? My colleague Kathleen Funchen has done a huge amount of work in terms of Sinn Féin's policy on childcare, and it would move to that universal childcare system. But I believe that our figures is that it would reduce the cost of childcare in the budget by 30% in the first year, and then progressively reduce over
and
the years.
And how much? What's the headline figure for how much that
I
would
cost? I don't
have
it in front of me. I was just looking there. I don't have that figure in front of me, but it is fully costed, because every year we...
Because that just seems like such a dream, that you'd wake up in a year's time and it'd be 30% less, and then the following year it'd be another 30% less, given the amount of money that comes out of people's pockets for that. It seems almost... impossible yeah, that, no, that, and that
and
could be achieved.
It is expensive, but that's the issue is, and I think a lot of people realise this when you're out talking to them on the doors, is that they want the public services rather than the tax cuts. And they know that, that how do you pay for those public services? You pay for that through income tax. And the problem in this country is we've been paying income tax all the time, but we don't see the services that you get in other European countries.
What do you think about that idea about a tax cut for middle income?
Well, I personally, I think it's much better that you have, it's very expensive to have tax income tax cuts. They make very little difference in terms materially to people because it might be the cost of a price of coffee. But they're going to take that money, has to come from somewhere. So you're going to have to not fund the public services.
So will Sinn Féin oppose a tax cut for the middle income?
Well, as I said, we have to wait and see what's put on the table. But our preference is for public services. And I really believe that the public want the public services. They want to be able to go see a doctor. They want to be able to get into an A&E without having to wait for 24 hours in one case in Tala. They want to be able to, you know, avail of childcare. You know, and another issue even around public transport, like for schools. So like that's another cost for families. They're oversubscribed, the school buses. That would address our emissions targets, but also reduce the cost for families, get their kids on school buses. They don't have to make those short trips, which reduces their fuel. Because again, that report today, rural households, transport is a big proportion of their costs.
And so we need 20% cut in transport costs for people and 50% for children.
No,
so
that was great, and I absolutely welcome that. And we need to see that continue. The problem is in lots of areas of rural Ireland, there is no public transport. Mm-hmm. So yes, it's brilliant for us in Dublin that have public transport, absolutely. But if you live in rural Ireland, those short journeys that you're making, whether it's dropping your kids to school or having to commute to your job, we have to find ways of reducing those costs for people. And one of the very simple ones is expanding the school bus system.
Okay, just to give you a flavour of what's coming into us on the cost of living issue. 3 litres of milk has gone from 1.99 to 2.59 in the space of a few weeks. That used to be the real political question, wasn't it, for politicians about how close to the ground were you, how much is a pint of milk? So 1.99 to 2.59 in the space of a few weeks. Similar for other staples. Yet the same supermarkets bombard us with 5 for 5 euro offers on chocolate, crisp biscuits, soft drinks, etc. Now that they can't reduce alcohol prices, that is not good for society. That's from Ed. We've an email in saying, why don't the government give people with young children a weekly child allowance payment instead of a monthly one? I suppose in times like this, when people are really scraping to get over the line, the timing of those payments is going to be important. And then we have, it's the second government representative, I think that's you, Shane, today, who has pointed to the money given to everyone for fuel bills as a targeted measure. Does Shane Castles know what targeted means? In relation to the childcare issue, that's one of a number of issues that Barry Cowan thinks Fianna Fáil needs to have a big conversation about. He brought forward a motion at the parliamentary party meeting last night.
He did. It was quite a broad motion, but it was sort of, I guess, in response. It was in response, I think, to a number of things. I mean, there was a Red Sea poll at the weekend which saw Fianna Fáil at 15%, Sinn Féin 36, Fine Gael 20, and I think there's a concern in Fianna Fáil that they're not necessarily carving out their identity in government very effectively. And you can see that the Taoiseach today in the Irish Independent giving what I think is his first print newspaper interview in quite a number of years, outlining his stall in terms of the budget. What are Fianna Fáil's priorities in terms of the budget? It's not immediately clear at this point now. I suppose we should say that the budget's 5 months away, but nonetheless, at a time when everyone's talking about alleviating the cost of living, the Taoiseach are coming out and talking about reducing childcare costs, higher education costs, tax cuts. You know, that potentially is quite attractive to voters.
And talking delighted to say a return to an oldie but a goldie. Mm. People who get up early in the morning.
Correct, yes. And I think I know you asked me about Fianna Fáil here, but I just think in terms of the Taoiseach's interview, you know, I think people will be somewhat sceptical of what he said in that interview because he has been either Taoiseach or Taoiseach for the last 5 years. He's been in government for 11 years. He's been talking about reducing the burden on middle-income earners, on people who get up early in the morning, since he became leader in 2017. And now there has been some progress in that in some respects, but not nearly enough, I think, to keep up with the acceleration or in inflation and the cost of living rising. But anyway, back to Fianna Fáil, I think that they're a little concerned about their identity within government. Barry Cowan's motion talks about that, but it also talks about setting a date for a border poll, which I think is
is something that he's suggesting could take place within the next 5 to 7 years.
And he's saying that one of the things he wants to have the discussion about, has a suitable venue to look at aims and ambitions for Fianna Fáil distinctive from the rest of government. And one of them is on a date, as you say there, for a border poll and Fianna Fáil being sidelined in debates on republicanism.
Yeah. Well, that's because Sinn Féin are leading the charge on that issue at the moment. And I think that Fianna Fáil are slightly irrelevant in that conversation. I think some people in Fianna Fáil would feel that way. I also think Barry Cowan is kind of dipping the toe in the water of a potential future leadership bid, because I think that...
Is that what this is about, do you think?
I think so. I mean, I don't have the evidence necessary to back that up, but I mean, certainly that's the kind of rhetoric from someone who's mulling his future as potential successor to Micheál Martin. I think that Barry Cowan might have looked at this quite differently a couple of years ago. But I think now the lack of any possible successor emerging to Micheál Martin, the fact that the likes of Jim O'Callaghan and, you know, others haven't necessarily put themselves forward at this point, the fact that it's fait accompli now that Micheál Martin is becoming tarnished in December, I think that's all kind of maybe perhaps making people such as Barry Cowan reconsider what they might have thought a couple of years
well,
ago.
Well, he's certainly got a wide agenda here. It's pretty much everything, the republicanism line, housing, planning,
it's ticking all the Fianna Fáil boxes, health, republicanism, child housing, care, health, public services.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, he's speaking to, or he's trying to speak to, a cohort of Fianna Fáil members who are a bit disillusioned with the way the party's going at the moment, notwithstanding the fact that Micheál Martin's personal ratings are very high.
Shane Castles, are you disillusioned with the way Fianna Fáil is going at the moment?
No, and I'm not concerned about my identity either. I'm 25 years in this party, 23 years as an elected rep, and I'm very confident, as Hugh has rightly pointed out, that Micheál Martin is doing a fine job as Taoiseach and resonating well with the public. And, you know, Barry, in terms of speaking about aims and objectives and policies, we actually have a policy committee established by the Taoiseach in January. Barry sits on it. We have several other policy committees established by the Taoiseach in January. I actually chair one of them on the communication side. We have an aims and objective one chaired by James Lawless, and all of those committees are going to report to the Ardesh
in
September.
So what's Barry Cowan up to here with this then?
Well, Barry can answer for himself. I'm saying that Barry sits on the policy committee of the party that is actually looking at all of those things that he's talking about. So I hope that when we see that report from Cormac Devlin, who chairs that, and Barry's a member, I look forward to it in September and actually teasing that out, no more than when I'll present my one in September also. And as I said, James Lawless is looking at the aims and objectives of the party and has actually met with every single party member across the country in all 26 counties, bringing forward this report for the party in September as well.
So what do you say to the theory that has just been expounded here that this is Barry Cowan positioning himself for leader, leadership?
We're a very happy camp now. We got together in Cavan last year. Hugh was there. I think he enjoyed a pint with us, and we had a very good, robust meeting.
COVID.
We had a very good robust
rules, Barbara Spells.
Well, we didn't get in anyway. We were there till midnight talking. The journalists were outside. I don't know what they were doing, but anyway, we were there in that room till midnight for 2 days. Thank God, my suggestion of putting the phones in a box was adhered to. So Hugh and
that
the
was
boys,
your suggestion,
that was,
was it?
Yes, so the boys weren't able to
so you were the suspicious mind behind
they,
that.
They weren't able to find out what was going on inside. So we actually had a really good, robust, frank, honest, God-fearing meeting, and Barry gave his tuppence worth as well. And since then, there has been really good, harmonious relations within the party, and we've seen that. We've seen Micheál Martin try since that period last. Call it a bloodletting, call it what you want. And I think there is actually a really good vibe within the parliamentary party at the moment, and that's permeating then down to the wider party as well.
And the 15% in the polls is not worrying anybody?
Well, again, you know, polls, you look at the Sunday, you look at the Red Sea poll, you look at the Sunday Times poll, which again, in terms of the methodology, uses a face-to-face and door-to-door methodology as well. And we're polling whatever, 23, 24% in that. I mean, I you don't want to see your party on any percentage of that nature of 15%. But I've seen us during the duration of this government sink as low as 9, go as far up as 24% in the Sunday Times polls as well. And as I said, the methodology using that one in terms of face-to-face is the one that I would have great credibility in. Apart from that, and talking to cabinet members, talking to people like Darragh O'Brien, who's out again now around the country, working on the housing initiatives, and the feeling on the ground is quite positive. And it's up to us as a collectively, as parliamentarians, to go out. We're the standard bearers for the party. It's our job to make sure we hold this party back to its prominent position in this country. That's as much a my role as it is everyone else as well.
Okay, Mark, did you hear people saying that Dara O'Brien is doing a great job?
I don't, and I don't hear them saying it in Kildare. You know, one of the biggest issues I deal with, Katie, on a daily basis is people on housing. You know, it can be 25, 30 calls, people looking for housing. I don't see the solutions coming to Kildare South. Like, people in my office last Friday coming in during the clinic were actually crying because they're getting notice to quit. This has been repeated time and time again by people coming in. The solutions are being talked about, but they're not being delivered on the ground. And in places like Attoy, Newbridge, and throughout, and talking to colleagues around, it's simply not happening on the ground. The houses are not being built, and that is what we need.
Do you not see the commencement notices are clearly up substantially? I can walk around my own town and see fields that lay zoned for 10 years where nothing was happening, and physically see literally thousands of homes being built. You know, we're not dreaming about that. I'm not looking into the field and going, God, what are they doing? They're building homes again.
I don't think you ever dream of anything like that when it comes to me, in fairness to you, Shane, but what I'm saying is that I can only give my experience of what's happening in Kildare.
No, I know,
but colleagues other are saying it as well, that they're not seeing the action, they're not seeing the houses being built. And what do you do when a person comes in and presents to you? And I had it three times last week and last Friday. They are crying because there's no solutions, there's nowhere to rent. And as has been said by Lynn, the rent prices are going through the roof. And there has been no changes in the HAP limits since 2017. This is what's happening there at the moment. And it is very difficult for a public representative to sit in front of a person when they're actually crying and try and give them solutions. And that is what's happening out there at the moment.
Okay, we will move on. Actually, we'll take a break and we'll move on, and we will go to gambling after these.
The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
Okay, the Joint Committee on Justice published its report on the Gambling Regulation Bill last month, ahead of the legislation going to Cabinet before the summer recess. A pre-watershed ban to be applied on all forms of gambling advertising was one of a raft of recommendations in that report. Hugh, what is the main thrust of this attempt to regulate gambling for the first time?
Well, I think it's aimed really at kind of cracking down on an industry that has been, there's a massive proliferation across all media outlets over the last, decade or so, really. I mean, you know, betting companies sponsoring sports teams, betting ads across the telly, betting ads on our phones, betting ads on, you know, everything. You know, proliferation of betting apps and so on and so forth. And I think just the ease at which people can gamble now is much different from what it was 10, 15 years ago. And I think it's an industry that whatever regulation does exist is pretty outdated at this point. So it's kind of aimed at kind of cracking down on that and having a regulator in place that I think can enforce the laws that will come into effect. And I think it's something, obviously, that is... You know, we've heard a lot more people coming out now and talking about gambling issues that they've had, gambling addiction, talking about it in a way that people might talk about other kind of substance or talk about substance addiction, alcohol addiction, drug addiction, so on and so forth. So, like, it is become a big problem, I think, in society. And I think this is a way of trying to regulate that. But obviously, it's something which is obviously facing a bit of lobbying and pushback from the industry itself.
Yeah, and I should just ask, just to be clear, none of you guys were invited to that Punchestown knees up?
No. I don't gamble as a rule. So.
As a rule?
Yeah, it's one vice I don't engage in.
Mark, can I put to you, is this an awkward one for somebody who represents a constituency which, you know, has a lot of people who you rely on racing and, you know...
Yeah, look, Katie, it's a very important question. And look, the racing industry is very important to County Kildare, but we have to protect the most vulnerable. And this is what gambling and the regulation that's coming down that Minister Brown is thankfully introducing. And we've got to bring that back, that we've had gambling regulation, or promise of legislation, should I say, since 2013. But now we're actually seeing it. And you know, on behalf of the Labour Party, I brought in my own gambling bill, which passed second stage in the Shannon, which was supported here by Shane and Lynn, to ban gambling ads, because Hugh is right.
Totally ban.
Totally banning.
So yeah, because I was going to say, this is a bit milk and watery, isn't it? What's in this legislation?
Well, I think we need to start there. There's some great stuff from that legislation. And what we're having tonight is another conversation. You again is right. There have been a lot of people out on gambling and talking about what's happening. You know, whatever report you read, and it can be from 30 to 50,000 people who have a gambling addiction in this country, those are the people that we need to help. And, you know, what the gambling companies deliberately do is to normalise sport and gambling. They want you to associate both together. So when you're watching sport, you got to gamble. And that's what those that are treating those with gambling addictions tell you time and time again. And indeed, you know, those that have come out and have spoken about gambling addiction, they, when they see gambling ads on telly still, they're tempted. And that's what we got to regulate. There has to be at least a watershed. We want to get rid of them altogether because we believe we've got to start there, give people a break. But we're not against gambling. We're not against gambling, but we need to see gambling legislation brought into this country to protect the vulnerable.
Lynn?
Yeah, no, I mean, we're way behind in terms of getting a grip on gambling in this country. It is the Wild West. I mean, I think Britain has a gambling regulator now for 16 years. But even back in 2017, I had a conference on gambling, and we had Samantha Thomas, who's an academic in this from Australia, over talking about the impact of gambling on children and the awareness children have through those advertisements. So children as young as 10 understood betting odds. So when you ask them, you know, if your team is 2-1 and the team they're playing is 5-1, which team is more likely to win? And they understood. Do you mean so? Because it's just, it's there, it's all pervasive, it's just constantly in their faces, and that normalisation is really critical, as Mark pointed out.
What do you say to people who say, look, obviously some people have an issue with gambling in the same way as some people have an issue with alcohol, but there is no suggestion that we, you know, ban those kind of activities. That is there a danger that you're going to, you know, throw out the baby with the bathwater?
Well, no, this is about regulation. So there's lots of people who have the odd gamble, or who gamble regularly but gamble quite responsibly. The difference between alcohol is at some point with alcohol you will pass out. Whereas you can just keep on gambling and gambling and gambling, and that's a real problem. And but also it's the insidious nature of particularly the online gambling platforms. So the fact, I think it's a 3-day wait before under 18s have the age verification, where before they have to put up their ID. But equally, if you try and disconnect yourself voluntarily because you might be feeling that you have a problem with your gambling activity, you will get push notifications through all of your social media. In the same way with online shopping, you know, if you didn't buy the item, they'll say, oh, did you forget?
Are you sure?
Yeah. You know, so it's that kind of, it's really just an insidious way of drawing people back in. And I mean, like we had at that conference as well, I think Tony O'Reilly, who was the postman who served time, and we had another man from England. And instead of actually at any point when they were going in, it was well known that these people had a serious gambling problem going into the bookies. Instead of stopping or trying to intervene, in the case of the man in Britain, he was given a trip to Vegas for being such a loyal customer. So, you know, we need to get a grip on regulate the industry, and the advertising and the online apps are critical.
Yeah, Shane,
and on that advertising, I mean, they've penetrated literally every aspect of Irish society. And I want to mention in particular, Oisín McConville has been just an amazing man for what he's done. And I don't mean about his media appearances. What people don't see is he goes out and he visits clubs all around the country. Came down to my own GA club, Navan O'Mahony's, and spoke for hours with the juvenile members, warning them against not getting involved. I remember he did an amazing piece on Radio 1 last summer where he spoke on Sunday Sport about his own particular. Here's the irony. When he was finished, Sunday Sport went to the opening day of the flat in the Curragh, and the little jingle beforehand was sponsored by Boyle Sports. Here's the irony that we've got a scenario where on radio we were discussing actually gambling addiction, and then the opening race from the Curragh was sponsored.
I mean, there is a lot of gambling. It just shows you part of the conversation.
But then they have such, I mean, it's worth around 10 billion in this economy, which is amazing. But the online bit, COVID was a godsend to these guys, a godsend. It used to be when, you know, Cheltenham and Beyond or something, there'd be the €5 coupon on the front of the tabloids, you cut it out, you go into the bookies, and so be it. I remember when the betting tax was increased a few years ago, they lobbied every single TD going, getting the staff to lobby going, if this happens, the betting shops will be closed. COVID came. They were delighted. Why? They drove every single person onto their phone and the online.
But
online
in relation app. To that lobbying thing, can I just go back to that Punch Us Down what would you call it? I mean, we're not, apparently it wasn't a lobbying.
Hospitality event.
Yeah. It was a hospitality event. How inappropriate do you believe, or do you believe it was at all inappropriate for politicians who were going to be asked to vote quite soon on regulation of an industry to accept hospitality from that industry?
I do believe it's inappropriate, and I said so on the floor of the Dáil, and I think so. I think Mark might back me up. I said it quite passionately that week in the Shannon, saying that, that you know, politicians would be in Punta, it was wrong, and if we're expected to legislate...
Did you say that before this story broke?
Yes, and Mark was there, he was in the chamber. We were, I think we were discussing your particular bill when we were discussing it, and I don't have any truck with them whatsoever. I think it's wrong. I have a particular... you know, we need to regulate this very, very strongly. And that's why...
And what do you think of the legislation then, Shane, in relation to... Because, I mean, I read that legislation and it's all about sort of we have to look at and we'll have to consider and we'll have to... It seems like we're a long way from grasping the nettle.
No, because I think we're going to have a gambling regulator in place and working towards actually establishing that office and the staff by the end of the year who has a sense of right where we need to get to very, very quickly. We discussed the online media bill in the Shannon this week. We got eventually after 228 amendments, we got to a point, and one of the amendments I had down was on the gambling section as well, to include it in the online media bill and the policies of government to reflect that, because that's where the problem really, really is.
Yeah, just do the panellists support the continued taxpayer funding of horse dog racing, two activities synonymous with gambling? Mark?
Yes, I have, Katie, yeah. Because I believe, as you pointed out in your opening question, that in fairness to my own county, it's very important. So I have, and I will continue to do so, but it needs to be looked at again. I have no doubt about that. And we are actually doing that at the moment in the Labour Party. So we are looking at that fund and where that money is going. But I do support that. I have voted for it in the past and I will continue to do vote for it.
I don't think we should get into a scenario where the horse industry in terms of, they are obviously synonymous with each other and intrinsically linked. You go to a race meeting and the bookies are there on track. The bookies on track are not really the huge problem. It's the online. And I think that the horse, we should recognise that as a sport and in terms of equestrianism, it's a massive part of Irish psyche, Irish society, Irish sport. So I don't think we should be, you know, conflating the two and trying to say we're against
Irish
horse racing.
Another texter, 51551 is the text line. Another texter is saying it's not the gambling that it's the problem. That is the problem. It's the technology we all hold in
Absolutely.
Our hands every day.
Yeah.
And can I also say, okay, there's nothing wrong with politicians going to Punchestown, because it's very important that we support their country.
Because
I have been there.
Don't take the free drink,
absolutely,
yeah?
Absolutely.
Okay. I'm watching the time and I want to move on to the Defence Forces issue, because, of course, Taoiseach Micheál Martin visited Irish troops in Lebanon last weekend to mark International Day of UN Peacekeepers. Back at home, the future of the Irish Defence Forces conference was told that not a single unit of the Defence Forces was at operating strength. Hugh, you were in the Lebanon with the Taoiseach.
Yeah, I was, yeah.
You get all the glamorous gigs.
I do. It's a beautiful country and it's hampered considerably by the fact it's got Syria to the east and Israel to the south, and it's economically a bit of a basket case. Fuel shortages, which mean that there's power cuts at night. And I mean, even coming back through the main airport in Beirut, Rafik Hariri Airport, International Airport, there was power cuts intermittently. For the couple of hours that we were there. The currency is out of control completely. I think it's $1 to 25,000 Lebanese lira. So it's a great tragedy in many respects. There doesn't seem to be any functioning waste service, for example. So there's litter all over the place. But yet it's beautiful. You know, you can look out onto the Mediterranean and it's a glorious sunset and sunrise and all this. But I suppose what the Taoiseach's main reason for being there was to visit Irish peacekeepers, to pay tribute to them. The International Day of the Peacekeeper was last Sunday. He went to the memorial at Tibneen, which commemorates 47 Irish peacekeepers that have died there over the many decades that Irish peacekeepers served there. What's really interesting is the locals really value the presence of Irish peacekeepers there. And I think it's something that the Taoiseach will have really kind of taken into consideration in the context of the discussion around the future of the Defence Forces and the future funding of the organisation. You know, the Chief of Staff, Lieutenant General Sean Clancy, was with him on the trip, and he said that, you know, he favours the kind of second option of the future on the future of the Defence Forces Commission, which is effectively that funding should be increased by 50%. That's 500 million a year. That's a considerable outlay, but nonetheless, that's kind of what he would like to see. And I think now the government's going to make a decision on that later this month. But certainly, I think, you know, the Taoiseach, on his kind of first visit to the Lebanon since he became Taoiseach, visiting the peacekeepers, I think will have plenty of food for thought, having met with them and seen the work that they do. And it's valuable work, you know. It's peacekeeping in its very true form, you know.
Mark, the 500 million is a lot of money in the context of what we're going to need money for in the next budget, but it's not even going to come close to plugging the holes that have been exposed in the Defence Forces.
It is a lot of money, Katie, but it's a start, and it's a start that I personally think that we need to look at and look at actively. In fairness, it's LOA 2 in the Commission on the Defence Forces report, and I think that's a very important report. Today I attended the PD4 launch of affiliation with ICTU, and that's where a lot of that money would hopefully go in addressing the pay and conditions that we've spoken about before on this programme. We need to make sure that our Defence Forces are rightly paid, and Hugh makes a point. We have this international recognition of what we do as a peacekeeping country. That's only part of it, but also included in that is primary radar. In fairness, we need to know for our own security as a neutral country who and what are flying over us and what's in our territorial seas. And I think that has to feed into this conversation as well. I know in our own party we've had that conversation and started that conversation over the last couple of weeks. I believe it's a national conversation that we need to have.
Do you believe we're really vulnerable?
Yes, we are. We've seen it there. Even if we go look with the HSE cyber attack, even if we look at that, that shows how vulnerable this country is. And we're still looking at the outcome of how much that's actually going to cost this country. So that's the type of figure that we've got to look at when we're looking at neutrality, when we're looking at defending this country. And I believe our neutrality has stood us in good stead over the last long number of years. We still should look at that. But we need to invest in our defence forces. We need to look at LOA 2, and we need to look at how much money it will take to bring our defence forces up to be a proud and neutral country, and I think that's where it needs to start.
Lynn Boylan?
Yeah, look, I think the key thing in terms of the Defence Forces is the pay and conditions, and that's where you start if there's going to be any increased expenditure on it, because the conditions are woeful at the moment.
And this, of course, is feeding this recruitment and retention crisis.
Yeah, there's a huge number of people leaving every year from the Defence Forces, and okay, now that it's welcome that they're able to use ICTU to have some sort of negotiating voice, and that's a very welcome measure. But that's what's critical in terms of our Defence Forces, and then absolutely you can look at what equipment they need, because of course they have to have adequate equipment to do their job, but you can have all the toys in the world if you don't have the representatives to use that equipment. I think it's the working time directive they're still in contravention of that law. I mean, the FEMPI cuts haven't been restored. So there's huge concerns around the pay and conditions. And that's where I think for Sinn Féin, we'd start there. But we accept that you have to invest in having a certain level of defence so you can protect your own, I suppose, territory. But, you know, that's a whole different thing to then giving up on your neutrality and throwing your lot in with a European Defence Fund. They're two very, very different things.
Which is the next question, yeah.
Yeah, and I think just on following on from what Hugh was saying about our peacekeeping forces, that's what Ireland is good at, and that's what we're respected at. Because we are military neutral, we are able to go into those countries and have that be held in esteem and seen as honest brokers. And I would hate to see that taken away from Ireland.
Shane, do you think that, obviously Leo Varadkar is trying to lead this and open this conversation about an EU army and, you know, a realignment of European defence and, one saying that Ireland should be in there on the ground floor designing whatever kind of an EU army might emerge from this?
Well, I think the Taoiseach has been quite firm in reiterating our neutral stance, but at the same time talking about the fact that in the world we live in, and Mark touched on, you know, nobody's neutral anymore when you've got cyber attacks as well. And a huge part of that report was talking about cyber security. And it's not like maybe what Russia are doing at the moment in terms of tanks just rolling in and invading another country, but that the attacks will come from a cyber threat as well, and working collaboratively on that. And that's where a huge part of that investment in the various tranches was being called for as well, and getting it up to that 3 billion a year that is needed in terms of investment. So I think that's going to be another big debating point in the budget, and making sure that money is put in over the next number of years to get us up to that level. And, you know, Hugh was right in terms of the respect that people have for Irish peacekeeping missions across the world. I was in Cyprus last week with the OSCE. I met with the Irish ambassador and was at the dividing line between the Greek Cypriots and the Turks. And not only in terms
of... In what capacity were you there?
I'm a member of the OSCE, the Organisation of Security Council of Europe. And we were discussing last week, actually, threats to democracy and involving journalism as well, and the role of journalism in that, as a former journalist speaking at that as well. And in terms of meeting with the Irish ambassador, we have a number of Gardaí positioned over there as well. They're hugely interested in the Shared Island initiative, and the number of Gardaí are actually helping now with the kind of minor disputes that emanate at these dividing lines as well. And they're actually going over and working with people on the ground, trying to make sure you're eradicating that as well.
Okay, but go back to the idea of the EU army. Where are you on that? Where's Fianna Fáil on that?
No, I mean, again, we've had the referendums. The last night I was on this show with you, Katie, and we had briefed with, and we discussed that extensively again that night as well. I mean, we referred to the referendum that we had to run a second time to make sure that people were assured we weren't moving towards that position. You can have...
But so when you hear Leo Varadkar specifically saying, OK, I don't think we'll get support to join NATO, but I think I will get a referendum on an EU army
Leo flies a lot of kites. OK, let's be honest. The man flies a lot of kites. OK, so I mean...
How very dare you?
You know, I mean, so I mean, that's his style. That's fine. I'm a member of a different party and we don't fly kites like that. So, I mean, we're very firm in our position in terms of our neutrality.
So you don't think that's a serious proposition that's being put forward by Leo Varadkar?
Well, he might want to put forward a serious proposition and see that, but that will be in the context of a new general election when he's facing the people and putting it to the people that he wants maybe his party, if they were in an overall majority or in coalition with Sinn Féin, to actually join a European army. And, you know, won't be supported by us.
I think Sinn Féin would be in favour of that, wouldn't they?
No, I don't think you'd get that into any programme for government now, Shane.
What do you think about that? That conversation being, and it's not the first time that Fine Gael, obviously, because we were, as you say, it's been kind of pushed and pushed.
Yeah, no, it is. It's certainly something that Leo Varadkar has been speaking a lot about in the last few months, kind of since the Russian invasion of Ukraine. It has kind of changed the sort of the picture from a defence point of view in Ireland. And even prior to the invasion, we had the Russian military exercises off the southwest coast of Cork. So certainly, and Ireland's inability to kind of police that, or to monitor that, I should say. So that has changed the conversation. Fine Gael is certainly more to the right on this issue. It's certainly a bit more hawkish on this issue. But I think that, you know, in terms of joining a kind of EU army, if that was ever to come to pass. I mean, I think that probably would require a constitutional referendum. And I think
it would definitely require
a constitutional referendum. And I do think that there has been, if you look at some of the opinion polling that has been done on this in the last few months, since it's become a topic, there is strong support for Ireland's position.
It's a neutral position,
yeah, and I think
neutrality
is strange because it's not neutrality in the purest sense of the word, because as the Commission on the Defence Forces, the future of Defence Forces found, like the Defence Forces have kind of admitted that we're not able to adequately defend the state. So in those circumstances, there has to be a conversation about upping that capability. That involves spending more money on defence measures. And I suppose that involves a situation where we're not reliant on the UK to monitor our seas and our airspace. You know, is going to require a difficult conversation.
Yeah, does the fact,
and the Taoiseach actually
does the
one,
fact?
One
can,
other
I,
important,
can I just yeah, put you? Sorry. Does the fact that we are that the UK are no longer in the EU leave us more isolated in terms of
absolutely it does. Yeah, and I think
this sort of the
Taoiseach did
comfort zone that we had there.
Speak in Lebanon to this idea that he would like to see a citizens' assembly on the future of Ireland's defence situation, scenario, policy, the policy. In the lifetime of this government. And I think that's something that will I think that's likely something that will happen, and I think that's going to generate an interesting debate. It may yet lead to a constitutional referendum, who knows. But I certainly think that what the kind of policy that Leo Varadkar and Fine Gael are pursuing is perhaps not that closely aligned to what the general public think, or what the majority of the public think,
well, just
where Ireland should be.
The bit of the public who is listening to us and texting us is saying... the Irish Army should just defend and serve Ireland, not foreign wars and regimes.
But
we serve neither King nor Kaiser.
Yeah.
And the people should utterly reject, this is a tweet actually, all of these militarist advances and focus on amplifying the call for neutrality, de-escalation and to stop the wars. There is, though, isn't there, an idea, a sense that since the Russian invasion of Ukraine, things have shifted. I mean, you know, certainties are gone. Or, you know, what we thought might was the way things would be has been shattered. And there's no doubt but that Europe are going to move ahead and do, you know, in terms of their security situation. And do we not have to somehow move with them?
I don't think so. I think it's even more critical that Ireland stake out its position as that military neutral country because we are then able, we are the ones who could be trusted in any negotiations or in the UN Security Council. There's a reason why a small country got a seat at that table. We can use and leverage those positions to try and de-escalate the violence, because at the end of the day, that's what everybody wants. Nobody wants this war to continue. But like throwing your lot in with the EU in terms of defence, and you're the mixture of countries that invaded other countries. Do you mean so France? Like, so you're aligning yourself with countries that are involved in conflicts or have been involved in conflicts around the world. So you lose that honest broker status. So I think it's more critical now that we retain that position, because it suits us. We're a small country. We're never going to be able to equip ourselves to protect ourselves against a country the size of Russia. That's just not possible. But we can use.
But you could make the exact same argument as a small country who can never protect ourselves in that way for, you know, aligning ourselves with other like-minded countries.
But at the end of the day, we want to move away from violence and conflict. We have to try and de-escalate, and that's what we are good at, and that's what we're recognised internationally as. And we're going to see even more. And I think it was Malice the last head of the army was saying, you know, that the climate conflict and climate refugees is going to come down the road, and Ireland would be in a unique position to go in and again be trusted to go into those areas and to be peacekeepers on the ground. They lose all of that if they throw their lot into an EU army.
I think that's why it would be actually good when Hugh was talking about what the Taoiseach suggested in terms of having that citizens' assembly and maybe speaking about it in a kind of calm fashion, rather than getting to a scenario where one day you're faced with a referendum, yes, no vote, and that kind of, you know, heated scenario that you would actually tease out. Because I think people will have, you know, maybe different opinions now given everything that has happened across Europe, and tease those out over a period of months.
Okay, before we go, is Mick, was everyone across this comment that was made in the coverage of the Jubilee Trooping of the Colour and the Irish Guard, and the reference to them as Micks, and it was actually a former Irish Guard that said it, and then there was a discussion about whether it was offensive to refer to members of the Irish Guard as Micks, or indeed, I suppose, Irish people in general as Micks. What do you think? Term of endearment or out-and-out racism, Mark?
I think it's been offensive over the years. I think we're dealing now, and we've just spoken about the professionalism that's in the Defence Forces. So I think it's wrong. I think those people that are there would take offence to it. I think we're talking about enhancing our Defence Forces. They are professionals at the end of the day, and I think that's a bygone day, and it should stay in bygone days.
Shane, do you feel strongly one way or another?
Yeah, I actually hadn't heard the coverage of it today, Gady, but I concur with what Mark said.
Yeah. Shane, no.
And we're working hard today. You didn't have time to listen to the news, you know.
I think no Irish person who's ever lived in Britain will tell you that you've been called a Mick or a Paddy as a term of endearment. Yeah. But I think what was more shocking about the presenter's comments was even the reference to the irrational Irish and Lawrence of Arabia, you know, his history. So it was certainly a window into a certain view.
A mindset, exactly,
of what certain people think of the Irish.
Hugh, what do you think about this?
I don't get too offended by these things.
No?
No.
Okay, we'll take our last break.
Email latedebate@rte.ie.